Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is a crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hemingway,
Eichmann,
Stranger in a Strange Land,
Dylan,
Berlin,
Bay of Pigs Invasion,
Lawrence of Arabia,
British Beatlemania,
Ole Miss,
John Glenn,
Liston beats Patterson.
Massive knockouts.
Ooh, ouch. Hello again, and welcome to episode 92 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the history podcast that cracks open Billy Joel's rock'em, sock'em, action-packed hit song for the most surprising stories of the late 20th century. I'm Katie Puckrick.
I'm Tom Fordyce.
Tom, I'm kind of wondering how we got to where we are today, because Billy thinks it might have something to do with Liston beats Patterson. Are we talking about punching contests again?
Look at your excitement, Katie. You've missed these, haven't you?
Oh, well,
it's been a while since we've had any baseball as well.
Oh, I'm just wasting away here. Yeah, we've covered a few fighters here. We had Marciano in the past.
Did, yeah.
Yeah, and Sugar Ray.
Yeah.
What's the whoop here with the Liston and Patterson?
This was not only a huge fight, Katie, it was for the world heavyweight title. It happened on the 25th of September 1962. Certainly the first fight did, because there was a rematch. But I think this is as much about the backstory and the afterstory of the two men involved. So Sonny Liston, and we'll get into this, but Sonny Liston came from a devastatingly hard background. 24th of 25 kids.
Wait, hold on. Stop press. 25 children.
25 children.
And he's number 24.
24. Grew up in extreme poverty and was seen by the establishment as a bad man. Now, he was a bad man in many ways, but we'll explore, Katie,
right,
if he was as bad as made out to be. And then Floyd Patterson,
yeah,
who was a smaller man and a great fighter, was more favoured by the establishment. Both would have career-defining fights later on with Cassius Clay / Muhammad Ali.
Mm.
So this is as much about how America felt about these fighters as the fight itself.
Right.
And Katie, here to help us talk through all these issues, I'm very pleased to say, is the boxing journalist Declan Taylor, also co-host of the excellent George Groves Boxing Club podcast. Dec, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'll take excellent. What a subject to get a teeth stuck into. And two fighters, not just one. Not just Marciano Robinson, two yeah, in one.
Shall we start with Sonny Liston and his backstory? Because
yeah,
he does things in his life that make him hard to love. But equally, when you find out what he went through, it's almost impossible not to feel at least some tinge of sympathy.
Yeah, I always think Sonny Liston is he's one of the, in boxing anyway, one of the most heartbreaking stories in all of boxing, if not all of sport, when you think about it. And like you say at the start, Tom, that 24 of 25 children, never had it easy, doesn't excuse the life of crime that he went into, ended up getting arrested 20 times or more, went to prison, actually went to prison during his boxing career as well. Fearsome guy, but the context, particularly when you look back at it now, massive time of social change, and he's at the heart of it as someone that nobody liked. This was not just white people disliked him, but he had detractors in the black community as well. And it's sad because people look at Sonny Liston and think, well, this guy was just sort of this big thug and none of it went in. But some of the things he said were quite sad because he did affect him and he did care. He did care about what people thought and how he was perceived by his race. It's an incredible story. Floyd Patterson gets in the way of him at the wrong time as well, because also we should point out at this time, there was a 3-4 year period when he was one of the greatest heavyweights of all time. And people forget that because it was quite a short, explosive spell. A bit like how people talk about Mike Tyson, to be honest. Hmm. People almost overlook that. He sort of burnt very brightly for a while. Hmm. And then he very literally faded away.
One of the things that really struck me was the intensity of the hardship that Sonny Liston had to endure as a child. He worked on his family farm. Apparently the family mule died and his father treated him as the mule.
Yeah.
He could be seen in the ring with welts on his back that were the legacy of his dad whipping him when he was working for him. So he came from this incredible hardship and this hard scrabble life where he had to do anything to survive. So that's going to make you a little walled off and not the most tender, accessible human being, I would have thought.
He escaped that when he was 13, so they say. So he ran away, turned up at St. Louis, and then I guess you get involved in crime, don't you? Especially at that time. What else is he going to do? That was where he turned. You know, for want of a better phrase, he basically, because he was such a fearsome bloke, he became, to all intents and purposes, a kind of mob enforcer. He's the sort of guy that if you wanted something done violently, Sonny's your man. But obviously, at the same time, there's money to be made and there's success to be had in the ring if you're that sort of person.
And in fact, in prison is where he learned to
exactly. To
box.
Yeah.
I mean, that was actually, going to prison was his saving grace.
Yeah, you know, and then to end up at the very top as the world heavyweight champion. It's an incredible story, but the context, yeah, especially the contrast with the story of Floyd Patterson is quite startling. And you can see, particularly in that era where people don't really have access to these characters. It's literally what the newspapers tell you, what you read, the odd snippet you might actually be able to ingest about these people. So in terms of like forming narratives and stories, it's far easier actually. You kind of have very little to draw upon to draw a conclusion. And it was clearly, this guy's a thug.
And so let's contrast it with Patterson's background.
So he was born in North Carolina, but his family moved to New York when he was young. He was thieving, got into petty crime, and they sent him to a reform school to sort him out, basically. And that was where he started to turn his life around. He started boxing when he was 14. So we're talking 1949. And he starts boxing, and he's very good very quickly. But he's small. He goes to Helsinki Olympics within 3 or 4 years of boxing as a middleweight, which is 75 kilos, which is really not big.
And he's 5'11"?
He's 5'11". He's not even 6 foot. So to think what he did at the heavyweight division is incredible. So he started off on a difficult path, but he turned it around much sooner than Sonny Liston. He's the hero, and he had that Olympic background. The great revered trainer Customato spotted him quite early on. He won the Golden Gloves, which at the time was massive. So he was earmarked as the hero at the time. But not only that, also known as the gentleman of boxing, you know, because the way that he spoke to people. And as far as I can tell, he was crippled by what people thought of him. And that's often the case when it comes to people pleasers. You know, a classic people pleaser, they really care what people think about them. And how that manifests sometimes is how you interact with people, how you speak to them. And reporters and such like loved that about him. It's the exact opposite of Sonny Liston.
Oh, that's so interesting, because Sonny Liston would be just so like, I don't give an F, you know. And also, let's contrast their physicality. What was the look of Sonny Liston? Because people always talk about his effect in the ring and his menace and how intimidating he is. Can you talk about his look and his whole manner?
It's funny you should say that, because if you read pieces about the time, you would think that he's this gargantuan kind of ogre. And then Patterson's like this slight guy. He's much bigger than him. Mm-hmm. But heavyweight terms then was different to what they are now. He's not 6'9". He's not 300 pounds. He's reasonably big and he's huge. And he has this incredible reach as well, which facilitates one of the best jabs in boxing history. You know, the long straight lead hand, which he throws amazingly, of course. And that's kind of the basis for everything that comes behind it. But it's clear that one of them is kind of scary and the other one is not so scary. Just an eye test will tell you that.
And they're different sorts of fighters. Well, you referenced Customato, the great boxing trainer who another 20 years on will look after a young Mike Tyson and in fact become Tyson's legal guardian, maybe looks after Tyson in the happiest period of an unhappy life. So if we're to look at the two men in the ring, Deck, describe to us the where they're fighting, because Customato, his fight has always had that peekaboo
yeah
style. So talk us through that.
So if you go and look at Floyd Patterson fights. This is exactly what it is, that peekaboo style. And at the time, obviously, there's the formation of all different styles and things are popping up and you get different things in the South and people are doing different things in New York. But Cuss clearly liked this peekaboo style, which essentially means your hands are up. And it hadn't necessarily been established that you want to put your keep your hands up because then you don't get hit as much, which makes a lot of sense. But at the time, it wasn't quite as simple as that. Anyway, so he had this peekaboo style, which also relies on head movement and slipping, taking your head, what we call, on and off the line. So the line, if you imagine, is punches coming straight at you, you want to take your head off either side of it, of course, makes perfect sense. And not only that, it's what we call a positive defense, is if you take your head off the line, you're still in range to deliver a counter shot, as opposed to a negative defense where you might take a step back and then you're not in range. And then when you really think about it, it's exactly what Mike Tyson did. And Mike Tyson was a small heavyweight for his era, peekaboo style, moving left and right, constantly countering over the top with hooks. Floyd Patterson had this incredible leaping left gazelle hook, as it was called. The parallels between Floyd Patterson and Mike Tyson are uncanny, and it's clear that they had the same mental. Yeah, and any of the footage you watch of him is beautiful to watch, and it's incredible because often the guys are bigger than him. But then you come up against Sonny Liston, who, I should add, not only was Cuss's trainer, but he was also his advisor and his manager, and for want of a better word or better phrase. So he never wanted him to fight Sonny Liston. He knew.
Because he knew he was too dangerous.
He sees a killer, he knows one.
So now we know all about how Patterson conducts himself in the ring. What are the techniques and the styles and the moves of Sonny in the ring?
When we talk about a jab, we talk about a lead hand thrown straight to head or body. So for a southpaw, that'd be your right hand. He's an orthodox boxer, carries his right hand at the back, left hand forward. So he's got this unbelievable jab because he's got this incredible wingspan. It's said that he had the same reach as Vladimir Klitschko, this big, you know, this giant jabber from eras beyond him. And then behind it, he's got incredible power, both hands, head and body. Just a fearsome guy, a brute. And like I said, in the sort of 3 or 4 years before he boxes Patterson for his world title shot, his first world title shot, long awaited, he is just on a rampage, knocking everyone out. All the other contenders just icing everyone left, right and centre. And people are like, they're seeing Floyd Patterson and thinking this guy doesn't need Sonny Liston. And then when you think about the context of it, nobody likes him. He's anti-establishment. He doesn't speak well. You can see why there was this, why they didn't want to put him in straight away, and particularly Cuss, who knew that. Then what happens is, like I mentioned, he has this real fear of being judged by people, Patterson. Mm. And people are starting to suggest that he doesn't want it with Liston. And Cuss wants to keep him away. So he almost manufactures this himself, that I need to do it because I need to prove that I'm not a coward. I need to prove that I can do it against Liston, even in the face of the advice from his coach and his mentor, Cuss.
And he is truly terrified of that coward tag.
Hugely.
Case, we referenced in the Joe DiMaggio episode, we referenced the profile of Joe DiMaggio written by the American writer Gay Talese, who also writes a staggeringly good piece about Floyd Patterson a couple of years after this fight, and it's simply called The Loser. And amongst the amazing facts and reflections that you get on Floyd Patterson is the fact that in his suitcase for every one of his fights, he would pack a pair of false glasses and a false beard. Such was his horror that if he were to lose and be recognised on the way out, the shame that would be brought on him, he would rather leave a venue in disguise rather than face an angry crowd.
Oh my gosh. So he's a fighter physically, but mentally can't really hack it. Like, the humiliation is almost his biggest foe. I'm really interested in this idea that Liston was considered so scary by other terrifying to me, big muscly men, the other men that he boxed. Let's talk about the psychological warfare. Was there something that would happen outside the ring with Liston before, like, was there something that he would do to kind of set everybody's nerves a jangle?
I mean, to start with, he was obviously huge, but he had said that he had 14-inch fists, so colossal fists. Mm. I never measured them. but that's what it said. And therefore, also it said that he had to spar in 22-ounce gloves. So to put that into context, heavyweight boxing fight, you'll have 10-ounce gloves. You'll usually spar in 16, 18. So you're talking 22-ounce gloves. Pillows, because the sparring partners just can't take it otherwise. They also said to have worn chest protectors at times, which is just quite brutal because you wear head guards, you wear a groin guard. The idea you need to something on your chest to stop your chest getting caved in by this guy. Ugh. So quite grim. So there's all these stories swirling around. And then he's the king of the stare down anyway. He said that Patterson looked away from him. Patterson sort of said, I look away from everyone. I don't really read much into it. But when you've got someone like him, he'd lost once, to be fair, on the come up. Apart from that, he's knocking everyone out. So he hasn't really got to do much. It's much like Mike Tyson, that it gets to a point where people are aware of how dangerous you are before you step in the ring, before you even make the fight. So just in your head, you know, this is a human that you kind of want to avoid physical contact with. But Patterson needed it. He needed it because he couldn't be seen as the person who in any way tried to avoid it. One moment that I think, and I believe it was on the undercard of when Patterson boxed Ingemar Johansson in a rematch, Sonny Liston was on the undercard too. He also won early. And JFK said, I would have preferred to see Patterson Liston than the two fights we saw tonight. Patterson heard that. He was told about this remark and he thought, the president is even suggesting I'm fighting this guy and my manager's telling me not to. And, you know, I need to fight this guy. I can't be the person who avoids him.
It must have been so hard for Sonny Liston, though, because on the one hand, his superpower is his ability to intimidate just with his look, just with a scowl, with a stare. But it's so effective that nobody likes him. And it seems that the optics of the two fighters were harder to tackle than the actual physical fighting itself. Let's talk about this whole idea of the good Negro, which Patterson was considered, versus the thug, which was Liston. And these racist stereotypes were being perpetuated even by the African-American community, which you had mentioned earlier. And their desire was to foreground Patterson as this cultural role model. I mean, that must have been so frustrating for Sonny Liston, who's probably thinking, I am an athlete at the top of my game. You know, why am I not being celebrated?
Yeah, it's an incredibly uncomfortable situation when you really try and think about how that must have been at the time. He was perceived as, quote unquote, the wrong version of blackness. And that was at a time when obviously they were on the cusp of this incredible social change. Percy Sutton, who's Malcolm X's attorney, and at that very moment was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the president of that, had said that Patterson represents us better than Liston ever could or would. This isn't just a white thing that they don't like this guy. There was this fear that he was in some way the wrong symbol of blackness. Right. And like you say, can you just imagine what that must have felt like for Sonny Liston, who's still a human, still hearing and perceiving this at the time. And that somehow Patterson is the guy that everyone believes should be how black people are represented. But he's saying, well, what am I doing then?
Chopped liver.
Yeah.
And some of this comes from the mob connections that...
Yeah, that wouldn't have helped.
Sonny Liston is supposed to have, and I'm never quite sure, Deck, how close he is to the mob. I mean, because a lot of fighters at that point, the whole heavyweight division, until Cassius Clay, until Muhammad Ali, had mob connections. And these are not nice men. They might have quite amusing names, men like Frankie Palermo and, you know, Binky Carbone, and, you know, but they are nasty men and they had power. So you didn't always have a choice.
No, precisely that. And particularly if you were to get involved in them at a time when maybe you weren't so revered or you weren't carving your own way through the heavyweight division and you were skint, then how'd you get out of it? And when you really think about it, if you're in the mob and you're trying to find an enforcer, who better to find than the most fearsome bloke that you can really find on the street, who then just also happens to be good at fighting? That's what he does. It's kind of murky. You don't really know where the link starts and where it ended, or how long they controlled him, how long they controlled many boxers at that point. Nobody knows that. But it's one of those kind of no smoke without fire situation where you think it followed him around for so long. And at the time, that was always used as the kind of stick to beat him with, that he's a mob man anyway. So how can he be allowed to fight for the pinnacle of sport and achievement, which it was 100% at the time? Not so much now, maybe it's faded in some way, but being the heavyweight champion of the world at that time really was that. So to have this kind of murky guy involved in the mob carrying that title was also a problem for many people.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon, and it was absolutely delicious. These are no-fuss, no-mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Take Katie and I by the hand here, Deck, and lead us into Kominsky Park in Chicago on this night in 1962. There's 18-odd thousand people there. What can we see? First of all, what can we see? Are we clustered around the ring?
Is the ring
brightly lit?
Yeah, exactly. Brightly lit ring. Exactly what you might imagine one of those old school boxing nights to look like. And like you say, 18,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it was at the time. And also, if you go back and watch the video of it, because it's available, on the telecast, they say that this is the most lucrative fight ever, which again, could well have been at the time. It was shown on theatres across the world. Obviously, no pay-per-view in your house or anything like that. There were 600 sports reporters there, which is incredible number to think about. Like, I've been at world title fights, maybe not world heavyweight title fights, but I've been at world title fights and it's me and two others.
Yeah.
600 of them. It tells you the landscape of the sporting media at the time and how people ingested this sort of event. But yeah, it's people crowded around the ring, booing for Liston. He comes in, he's wearing white, and you've got the contrasting figures. Liston, this surly guy, pats him with his nice hair. It was a colossal deal. The president's talking about it. Civil rights activists are talking about it. It's the number one sporting sort of achievement in the world. And you have this guy that nobody likes and nobody wants to win, but everyone kind of knows is going to win on his way there, going into the ring, about to end boxing. In fact, that when he does go on and win the fight, spoiler alert, people say it was the death of boxing, because you can't have this guy as the world heavyweight champion.
I don't understand the death of boxing. You just, this man came in and advanced the sport with his skills.
Yeah, exactly. That's how you would look at it now. But this is how damaging people thought it was to have Sonny Liston as the world heavyweight champion.
Wow.
That it would kill the sport. I must say, we're told that boxing dies every 3 weeks now. But then it was a big thing. I mean, when you really think about the context of it, what damage did it do to the sport? Maybe it did damage the sport. In that sense, because it really was if Floyd Patterson had won that, it would have been this incredible moment for the civil rights picture as it was perceived at that time, and he didn't.
And this is a narrative, Deck, which goes back through boxing, the idea of a black champion who is considered good or bad by the whites in America. So Joe Louis was considered a good man because he fought in the Second World War, did he? Whereas Jack Johnson was considered an ogre, much like Liston, a bad man.
Unforgivable. Yeah, exactly that. So it was kind of one or the other. And you sort of nailed your colours to the mast in that sense, in that you were one or the other. And it carried on throughout boxing history, in that, like we say, race was such a huge social subject at the time, and it still is to this day. But back then, at that time, it was crucial.
The weird thing is that the fight itself is massively underwhelming.
Yep.
Not only is it short, not only is it wrapped up in the first round, but Patterson gives a very poor account of himself.
Yeah. So in one of the reports, I believe Sports Illustrated, one of the long reads up, which they were, said never has so little been seen by so many because it was such a colossal event. And like you say, within a round, it's over. And not just over, but he's done.
What goes wrong for Patterson?
He needs to, as a smaller man, against someone with a long jab, you have to get close, or he's got no chance. You need to use your peekaboo style, slip inside. When you get there, you need to do some damage to the body, try and slow him down. He needed to somehow last a few rounds, Liston this wrecking ball, get him through a few rounds, get him, let him get tired, work his body, put water in the basement, as we say, and then take over later on. Use this superior skill set that guided him to Olympic gold, that guided him through all these defences of world heavyweight champion. Instead, he just sort of hangs about in the mid to long range, the worst place you can be. He just gets picked off. I think he attempts one of his gazelle hooks, which doesn't make a dent in him. Mm-hmm. And he just takes over, uppercut every shot in the book. And worse, when he gets close to him, when Patterson finally does get close to him, Liston, the bigger, stronger man, he wins those exchanges as well. Like you say, it's almost underwhelming. And it should be this incredible contest for this unbelievable prize, and it's just a mismatch. And that's exactly how this felt. And Patterson accepted that he got it wrong. He said his head wasn't in the game. He said, my thoughts were lingering. And maybe he did freeze. If he's so worried about what everyone thinks, he maybe did freeze on that stage. There were questions about his chin from the Ingemar Johansson fight. He'd been stopped by Ingemar Johansson. A good chin means that you can hold a shot. So you get hit in the face and you're okay. And if you haven't got a good chin, you've got no chance against Sonny Liston at that time.
Did these men know each other outside of the ring, socialize at all? Or
I wouldn't have thought so.
No.
That's a very good question, but I think the circles that they moved in were very different. Patterson was ahead of him in terms of his progress because of the Olympics and everything else.
Sure.
And also he was on a different path, the sort of B-side path, and it happens even today. If you're not the golden boy, you go a certain other way. And he had to wait a long time for that shot. And also bear in mind at that time, there's one title. So there's one world heavyweight title.
Right.
Now there's four belts.
Right.
So you could quite easily beat Floyd Patterson today and Sonny Liston wins another version of the world heavyweight title and you never have to go anywhere near him because he's too dangerous, but you could still just defend, never go near Liston. At that point, you couldn't.
So, Tom, I'm thinking that Patterson probably reached into his little tote bag after the fight and whipped out his fake beard.
Yeah.
And whatever else he had. What else did he have? Prosthetic nose?
The strange thing is the greater humiliation is almost reserved for Liston, because Liston goes back to his adopted hometown of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And gets off the plane and he's the world heavyweight champion and he's expecting an adoring crowd and there's no one there but the baggage handlers.
Yeah. And he's expecting something and there's no one there.
That is crushing.
It's so crushing. And you're right, Patterson leaves in shame, although he said it wasn't shame, he just didn't want to be recognised, but it's shame that is the driver behind that.
Sure.
But then Liston goes and he thinks he's finally done it.
Yeah.
And in that sort of fashion, and there's no one there. At the time, it was written, so it is true, in a fair fight between good and evil, evil must win. And a celebration for Philadelphia's first heavyweight champion is now in order. Emily Post probably would recommend a ticker tape parade. For confetti, we can use shredded warrants of arrest. You know, so this is what they're talking about. So he's done it, but really he can't shake off.
And that was just in the local paper.
That was a local paper.
In Philadelphia.
And he said, this is funny, because it signaled a change in how he started thinking about reporters and what people said about him, is that he said, I'm not going to hate this person, this writer. I'm going to try and get him on side. He said, now I got that title, I want to make a deal with sports writers all over the world. If I do something bad, I want them to tell the world about it. But if I do something good, I want them to tell the world about that too. If the time of the rematch comes around, I haven't proved myself. If they can't say I've been a credit to my race too, then I want to give Patterson the title back. Just give it back. And he don't even have to fight me for it. He said he used to listen to Joe Lewis fights on the radio and hear the commentator always say he's a credit to the sport and he's a credit to his race.
Yeah.
So he craved that. And he thought that winning the world title would change that. It didn't. If anything, it sent him further the other way.
It's so cruel, isn't it? Particularly because apparently a lot of this public image was at odds with the private man. You know, you hear stories about him regaling people with great comedy skits where he does all the voices in the right order.
Yeah, this is what I mean by this heartbreaking figure in sport, because it's all of that. And he's clearly a sensitive guy and lucid and intelligent. Because of the way he's perceived and really because of the way that he's projected, externally by the media, and that's the only way really people can consume that. That is the only opinion of the time. There's no chinks anywhere. There's no, oh, maybe he's not, but oh, maybe he could do, there's none of that. Nobody goes to the thing. The death of boxing. One report said that no promoter in the land would put on the rematch because it was a farce. There were suggestions that Patterson had thrown the fight because the mob had lent on him to do so. So one report said that he'd even been threatened that by the mob that if he didn't lose the fight, then they were going to get rid of him. It's over and around. They think there must be something untoward here. But it wasn't. It was just a blizzard from Liston.
There's a rematch the following year, in the following July, and if anything, it's more underwhelming. I mean, it lasts 4 seconds longer, but there's no change to the dynamic whatsoever, is there?
It's quite startling how much of a carbon copy it is. One thing I always think is quite sweet, so it takes place 10 months later, like you say, which struck me as quite a long time, which it is, at the Las Vegas Convention Center in June, so hot, but by then it's all air cons and whatnot. It's supposed to happen in Miami in the April of 63, but Sonny Liston, this fearsome beast, hurts his knee playing golf, and they have to push it back by 3 months just to get him fit again. So no one could put a dent on him, but he swings that dodgy that he's injuring himself playing golf. On a Monday night as well, and again quite sweet, the idea that gamblers would come in for the weekend and instead of flying home, they'd stay and watch this fight, which if anyone's ever been to Las Vegas on a Sunday, it's the most bleak place you'll ever encounter in the whole of the world. So imagine hanging around for the Monday, but again, a different time. Very much a carbon copy. The only difference is that Patterson gets dropped slightly earlier, but does get up this time. But by that point, he's a sitting duck. And
you think he'd kind of put in some extra hours in the gym and but I think this skip is the, some rope? And
this is the point, though, I think, is that he could have done anything he wanted to, but he was no match for Sonny Liston, no matter what. Yeah. And like you say, 10 months is a long time. You could do other things. Maybe Liston could take his eye off the ball. I must say, some people had suggested that Patterson, who had been stopped by Ingemar Johansson quite badly, had regained the world heavyweight title in the rematch. So he had previous of turning fights around. Mm. So they thought maybe he could do it this time. Maybe if he gets it right, people were backing him to do it. And then it was the same fight. And it's the same again, but only this time Patterson's getting booed as well in the start of the ring, because by that point his credibility is shot to pieces because of the first fight.
And all the time we've had this narrative about how this will affect civil rights and who's good and who's evil. All the time there is a meteor racing across the sky from another direction that will fundamentally alter not only the course of heavyweight boxing, sporting culture, and the lives of these two men. Mm. So this is, as he was at the time, Cassius Clay. Two of the most infamous fights.
Yeah.
The first one, Cassius Clay, because he's still Cassius at that point, is said to have absolutely no chance, because we've seen what Sonny Liston has done
to the smaller guy.
To the smaller guy. And we've never seen a fighter like Cassius Clay. We've never seen someone that quick, that agile. So talk us through that famous night in Miami when he shakes up the world.
First of all, to take it right back to that rematch, is that they had fighters at the venue who were kind of introduced to the crowd, one of them being Cassius Clay, on the night in Las Vegas. They sort of touch gloves with Patterson, he touches gloves with Liston, and he pretends to vault the rope because he's so scared. You know, he's already being this comedic character. And Patterson's laughing at him, you know, and he's making a bit of a scene. But even if you read the reports from the rematch, people are saying there is Cassius Clay, but he's miles off it. And then his first defence, Sonny Liston, is against Cassius Clay, another smaller guy. So how is he going to stand up to this fearsome guy who is all, now is finally proven himself? So how can Cassius Clay do it? And he did.
And in the rematch between Liston and Cassius Clay, we go back to this idea, Declan, of the mob and their hold in boxing. So this is one of the most famous knockouts / pseudo knockouts that the sport has ever seen. It also gives rise to one of the iconic photographs that the sport has ever produced of Sonny Liston, this supposedly unstoppable man, flat on his back, sparked out, and Cassius Clay standing over him with his fist cocked in victory.
So I would say as well, the month before the Liston-Patterson rematch, so June 1963, Cassius Clay beaten Henry Cooper, Henry at Wembley, but he nearly got stopped himself in the fourth round. And then if he gets stopped by Henry Cooper, the whole sport changes.
Nothing happens. No. Wow.
But then to think, he almost gets stopped by Henry Cooper. How can he do this against Sonny Liston? But then it's exactly what he does. That photo is incredible. This photo and the context of it is, how could that have happened without some sort of outside interference, i.e. as the mob got on top of this? Is there some sort of betting scandal? The punch that finishes it as well, you barely see it. The phantom punch. People suggest that he's chucked it.
I watched that fight on YouTube, and they slowed it down, and you can see it does land squarely, but when you watch it at real speed, it looks like it didn't really happen. It didn't touch him.
That's the beauty of Muhammad Ali, isn't it? And that's the point. And even in the interviews after, people say, did you even hit him? He's like, your cameras aren't fast enough. And to be honest, he's true. He's right. And Liston just can't quite believe it. And like I said, when he's been beaten in the past, the people he didn't stop were people that he couldn't scare. He couldn't scare Cassius Clay. In fact, he thought he was completely mad. I really think that unsettled him. And then it comes to it. How do you deal with a mad person? It's impossible. Or at least when you're used to scaring people into defeat, when you've got someone who can't only be scared but can't be reasoned with in any way, how do you possibly beat that person? And he couldn't do it. And that was his first defense, Sonny Liston. And that's the other thing you need to remember when we talk about the context of great heavyweights. His first, he waited all that time. He did such unbelievable business against Floyd Patterson. His very first defense, that happens. And he's done.
And then, just to tie up all the loose ends, there is the fight where Floyd Patterson will fight the man who's now calling himself Muhammad Ali. This is in Vegas in November 1965.
Yeah.
And the tables have turned now because Muhammad Ali is a member of the Nation of Islam. He's hanging out with Malcolm X. He's assimilating all this culture. And Floyd Patterson, who has formerly been seen as the face of civil rights, publicly at least, doesn't like this. Mm. He refuses to call Muhammad Ali Muhammad Ali. He refers to him as Cassius Clay. In the fight, we maybe see the least edifying side of Muhammad Ali that we will ever see.
I think really it shows it's kind of a stark display of how the civil rights and how quickly it moved at that time. That by that time, and what we in by then, 65, that whole whirlwind of Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali has taken place. And then you've got Floyd Patterson. He used to be the established champion that people were trying to knock off the top. Now he's the challenger again.
And he's getting taunted by Muhammad Ali, yeah, is that right?
Throughout. And he taunting everyone at that point. And there's this huge reluctance for people to acknowledge the change that he made.
Because to change his name.
To change it, but not only change his name, but this allegiance with this religion. Many people were obviously unsure about it, were scared of it. And really at the heart of racism is fear, isn't it? And people were scared of that. Scared of just how open he was about this as well, because there was always that feeling of you can do things, but you need to do it, and it needs to make sense. It needs to be, you know, at the behest of the establishment. You can't just do what you want. And he did what he want, and then that also whipped up support in certain areas that again was scary for people. So he was this totally feared guy, but Floyd Patterson was still the establishment man. So you can just imagine what that must have been like for Floyd Patterson, because he's always been the good Negro. And now he's in there against the guy who seems to be leading the way or flying the flag, but in a different way.
Yeah, because Muhammad Ali is somebody who has the courage of his convictions. He's striking out, doing something that is considered taboo or a little recherché, and he's still winning and he's still faded. So I guess there's insecure Floyd Patterson thinking, yeah, wait a minute, my little playing it safe and colouring within the lines is losing steam and is a little dated.
It's very dated, is exactly it. By that point, it's retro, because that is not good enough by that point, or in many people's eyes and in the eyes of certain civil rights leaders, that is not good enough anymore. And they need something else to make the change. And Muhammad Ali is that. But not only that, you could barely touch him.
And in the course of that fight, how does Muhammad Ali treat Floyd Patterson?
He boxes him, I think it's a 12th round stoppage. He knows what he takes it as a opportunity.
The theory is he could end that fight.
He could end it whenever
earlier.
He wanted. And this is always the thing with boxing, is that boxers will always say, well, I don't hate this guy, it's just business and I don't dislike him. And if you really did hate someone, would you try and clean them out with one shot, or would you beat them up, a sustained beating, and then kind of take them out late?
And whilst that's going, he is shouting at Floyd Patterson.
Yeah, exactly. Saying, what's my name? You know, all this stuff. And that became synonymous with Muhammad Ali throughout his career. Again, against Ernie Terrell, the same, which refused to acknowledge the change of his name.
And there is no happy ending for Sonny Liston.
No.
In fact, it's probably the bleakest of endings, because he's not an old man when he's found dead in 1970.
No.
For a man who people don't really know his exact date of birth.
Yeah.
The way he dies, people aren't there when he dies.
So after the fight, after the second Patterson fight, he has a series of fights in Sweden, comes back to America, puts together a little run, but he kind of never gets back in the big time. And actually, when you look at his record, he never boxed the Joe Frazier's or, you know, these other big heavyweights of that era. He never got put near them. His last fight was in 1970, against Chuck Wepner. But by December the 30th of that year, so just before New Year's Eve, he's in his house, lovely house in Las Vegas, and he dies on his own. And then a few days later, his wife returns with their seven-year-old son with this horrible smell, finds him upstairs dead. Like this once great heavyweight champion, he's dead at the foot of his bed, blood come out of his nose, and it's this mysterious situation.
Do they know what killed him?
So it's said they find some heroin in the house. It's suggested that he's a user, but a recreational user, if that's possible.
There's no needles found. There's no paraphernalia. No, it's just this bag of heroin, yeah, which leads this idea it's a plant, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's suggested, though, that there are some sort of like needle marks in his arm at the time. But again, it seems like a plant. It seems like some sort of frame. Then it's suggested that he's fallen over and hurt himself. Eventually, the coroner reports that it was natural causes, heart disease and organ failure or something like that. One of my old university lecturers, Rob Steen, wrote a book on this, and he said nobody really believed that a heart attack killed Sonny Liston, but nobody ever found out what killed him.
He was kind of scrabbling around after his boxing career was washed up, and he wasn't he working as an enforcer for the mob
so
in
they
Vegas?
Say he was back to that. So then what happens in those stories, you end up getting killed. And so that was the end of Sonny Liston. And the most tragic, heartbreaking thing about him is that his gravestone is in Vegas, and it reads Charles Sonny Liston, 1932 to 1970, a man. That's all it says on his gravestone.
How do boxing aficionados judge the Liston-Patterson fights today? Has the technique changed over the years? Would you watch it now and go, oh, the strategy's all wrong? Like, would boxers today approach it differently?
I think it's one of those technically where it hasn't changed that much. And Sonny Liston's tools are still thus that you could put his jab on any heavyweight now and it's an incredible weapon. That peekaboo style, like we say, was then taken by Mike Tyson to another level as a sort of bigger, stronger unit. It's funny with boxing, there's a difference in the technique, but a lot of it is much the same. The way they throw their hook, what we have now is derivative of back then. And old trainers still do the same thing. A lot of the training techniques are the same. Sometimes to boxing's discredit that it's kind of behind the times and it's very old school and it needs to catch up. But these sorts of things, a good jab from a heavyweight, or the way that Patterson moved his head and set up attacks like that, it still works to this day. At the end of the day, it's two metal women having a fight in their underwear. Like, that doesn't change, and it hasn't changed over the last 60 years.
It's a punching contest.
It's a punching contest.
Declan, I knew I would enjoy this episode, and I wasn't wrong. Katie, I hope you have come along for the ride now through a succession of baseball and boxing episodes that Billy has served up.
100%. If I'm not hitting a flying missile with a stick, I am dodging a fist in my face.
You got to make him pay after that, though. It's no good making a miss. You got to make him pay after.
I don't know what it means, but I want to get my money.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Do, 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 do.
Tom, there's always so much more to a story than meets the eye. You get into the background of these men, the hurdles that they had to overcome to get to where they are, and then the hurdles that remain after they triumph, supposedly. It's kind of a downer.
Katie, I almost feel it's my personal responsibility when we get to the sporty end of Billy's lyrics that I take you by the hand and make it fun for you, because obviously that used to be my world.
Yeah.
And I think the whole secret with sport is that actually it's not really about the sport. It's about the men and the women who do it. It's their backstories. It's their personalities and their characters, their flaws and their triumphs. That's what, for me, always made sport interesting.
Well, it's what hooks you in, and it's kind of a little microcosm of all of the struggles that we face. But I don't know if this is indicative of how shallow I am as a human being, but all attention to the matter at hand melted away when I heard Declan discussing the peekaboo style, the peekaboo style. And I found myself wondering, what would be my style in the ring? I think my style, Tom, would be the perky pony prance.
Tell me more.
Well, I think there'd be a lot of fancy footwork. There'd be a little skippity-doo-dah. I'd be leaping out of the way of getting slugged in the head, because I don't think I'd enjoy that very much. But I do like the idea of just skippity-dippity-doo-dahing like a perky little pony prancing around that ring. Sounds like a good use of my talents. How about you? What would be your signature move?
Well, I have tried my hand very briefly at boxing. And what I found was that I really enjoyed the dancing around the ring.
Yeah.
As soon as I got smacked in the chops, all my love of what I was doing went out of me very quickly. You know, it's as Mike Tyson once said, everyone's got a plan till they're punched in the face.
Well, that pretty much goes for anything, I think, in life. If you'd like another podcast to listen to, Death of a Sports Star tells the stories of the sports stars that we lost too soon, like Kobe Bryant, Flo Jo, and even Sonny Liston. And our very own Tom Fordyce wrote some of these.
I did, Katie. If you would like to give them a listen, just search for Death of a Sports Star wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you're still thirsty for more, have a listen to our previous boxing episodes with Steve Bunce, Buncey, Marciano, and Sugar Ray.
And while you're at it, please make sure you check out our lovely merch collection at spreadthatfire.com. If you happen to have any guest ideas, or maybe just something you want to share with Katie and me, you can contact us. Email is fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk. On social media, we are at Spread That Fire on both Instagram and Twitter.
Next week, Tom, no, it's not an extension of British Beatlemania, but it is a fellow named Paul. Pope Paul, to be exact.
But which one, Katie?
There are so many. There's numbers attached. There's John Paul, Paul John's. Maybe even Paul John George Ringo? Dunno.
I hope so.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe. and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.